You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Happy holidays to you, whether you celebrate Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa, or maybe nothing at all. It is a time for family, friends, and those we hold dear. Well, earlier this holiday season, we asked you to tell us about your most unforgettable holiday memory. And KCRW producer Danielle Chiriguayo reached out to hear more from some of you, and today we present a couple of stories. Both of them are tales about a parent, a child, and something special that happened at Christmas.
This is Peter Wittenberg from Glendale. I was a student, and I was a single father to an 8-year-old little girl, Chloe. And it was Christmas, and I decided that we needed a Christmas tree, a real Christmas tree with the scent of a tree that'll fill the room. Went to the store, and it was only $25 back then. And I couldn't afford it. I didn't have enough money. So back at home, I found a bare spot on the wall in the living room, and I nailed some Christmas lights on the wall, and I did it in the shape of a Christmas tree. You know, the base of the tree touched the floor, so it kind of looked like it was standing on the floor in a way. I stood back and looked at it, and I thought I was the worst father ever. I mean, I couldn't even afford a real tree for my daughter. I brought my daughter home from school, and we walked into the living room, and she looked up on the wall and saw her new electric tree, and then she just ran out the front door, and I was left standing there going, what the heck was that? What, does she like it? Did I fail? And then she comes running back in with two of her friends, and she goes, hey, look at my Christmas tree. And her friends go, wow. I was so scared. I was so embarrassed, really, of what I had done. But my daughter loved it. She didn't care if it was real or not.
Hi, I'm Jeanette Elliott.
My name is Elliot O'Ryan.
Yeah? Can I make a request?
To this day, neither of us knows why or remembers why, but he just got it in his head that he wanted to play violin. I held off. I kept saying, well, let's wait, because he seemed so young to start on an instrument, especially when it's so difficult. I knew that about the violin. But he wouldn't let it go, and he kind of pestered me regularly, and I finally said, okay. And not long after, not too long, maybe 6 months, he had his first recital. And I remember he got on stage and his teacher and I looked at each other with this, well, we tried kind of look, because she wasn't convinced he was going to do well. And she was very good with him, very patient. Her patience was amazing. And then he started to play. And we were just, when he was done, we were like, who was that? No matter how mediocre he seemed at home, he'd get on the stage and just blow us away. So she entered him every year into a competition. And every single year, he got the highest score that you could get. And then he continued to play, you know, all through high school. And then right before I moved out here, his life changed. You were 19, right, honey?
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to talk about that day?
I was with my girlfriend. We were moving into our own place out of my best friend's place. And the big glass table had a small crack in it. And I was carrying it down the stairs, and it snapped. And it severed three of my tendons in my arm. And my ex-girlfriend called my mom, panicking, telling them to meet me at the hospital. And they did surgery. They reattached my tendons, and I had a cast all the way up past my elbow for like almost a year. And they also said, you may or may not be able to play violin or guitar or any of the other instruments that you play ever again. Just letting you know, it might not be possible for you to use those fingers. It was a moment of just panic, like this sinking feeling of like your throat dropping into your stomach, dropping into your gut. That was probably the scariest thing that I could imagine, was not being able to do what I loved more than anything in the world. And they just handed me a big prescription for oxycodone and said, gave me like 7 months of refills on it. I got addicted to them, plain and simple.
Elliot did call me at one point and say, he was very open. He said, Mom, I'm addicted to these pills and I can't get off of them. And I said, okay, you know, I'm a mom. Action is needed. And I called his father and we're good friends. And I said, look, Elliot's addicted to this, the pain pills he was put on. And he's really, really freaking out. And can we get him into, can you get him to a rehab in Ohio? Because I was out here with the other two kids. And he got him in right away.
It was a very small 10-bedroom facility, literally in the middle of nowhere in Kentucky. It was just detox-based. I was only in that facility for 6 days. It should have been so much longer. And so it just wasn't enough. And I was right back to using as soon as I got out of there, basically.
So it was almost a year. I came out here in August. One of our neighbors called me and said, I'm really worried about Elliot. There's something really wrong. As much as he denied it when I would ask him. So flew him out here. And I have to say, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but when you got off that plane, it was all I could do to hold back the tears. I had never seen someone so sick.
I actually did cry when the plane landed. It was really powerful to have a chance. But it didn't last. It didn't last. I came out here, you know, got my violin back, doing violin stuff, you know, and I had a bunch of minor relapses where I'd like go back into it for like a couple days or a week and then I'd get back out of it. It was around that time when things got really bad. I was attacked. I was mugged late at night in North Hollywood, and a guy beat me almost to death with a hammer, and he had chiseled one end into a blunt axe. My lungs were punctured and bleeding. Most of my ribs were shattered, and I woke up 3 days later in a trauma unit with a morphine drip. And that's like a death sentence to people with, you know, an addiction. And I think I said to my mom, like, I was crying, and I was like, she didn't even know where I was for 3 days, you know. I was like, I don't want this disease. I was like, just sobbing, like, I don't want this, because I knew it was going to happen. It sent me into the darkest place, the kind of derelict homelessness and addiction that I would not wish on my worst enemy. It's a hard place to be. And I started renting a violin, and that was the only thing I think that kept me from dying. And I would busk, you know, just that random homeless person that you see playing an instrument out on the street. I was one of them. And it kept some clothes on me and ability to wash them and kept up my drug habit. But it also gave me that tiniest bit of hope in, like, the darkest place was the fact that I was starting to be able to move my hand and play the violin again.
The next, I don't know how many couple of years were the most terrifying I've ever had in my life. Elliot has two siblings and a father and cousins and people who love him, but we were watching him die. It changed who he was. It changed how he looked, how he spoke, how he acted, how he thought, how he felt. It was like, these drugs were bleeding him of, like, his soul. And it's terrifying for a parent, because there were times I thought I would bury this child of mine. I would run into him up, you know, on Victory once in a while, and we'd talk.
The night before Christmas, my mom's friend got me a room, a nice room, a nice Airbnb room for Christmas, so that I wouldn't be out on the streets, you know, that I have a nice place to just sleep and have some privacy and not wash myself in a, you know, Panda Express bathroom. And me and my mom were in the car, and I was about to go there, and then my mom got a call from this place that I went to, this rehab, Tarzana treatments, and they're like, oh, they have a bed. And my mom was like, all right, we have to go. And I was like, no, please, I'm not ready. I just need, just give me this one night in this Airbnb to take a shower and have privacy, because I know when I go in there, I'm not going to have any of that. you know, I'm going to go through hell. Just give me this vestige of peace before I go. My mom was scared, rightfully so. And we had a big fight about it. And my mom said, you're not going to go.
And I really regretted, as soon as I said it, saying, you're never going to go. That was the desperate words of a parent that shouldn't have come out of my mouth, but they did. And he was so upset by that. So we parted ways. He spent the night there. And yeah, I went to pick him up in the morning because I said, I'll pick you up. But he was gone.
I didn't have a phone. I had already left.
And I was devastated. They said the bed was only going to be there Christmas Eve. And now it was Christmas Day. And I thought, that's it. We missed it. On my way back home, I just had another one of those strange mom feelings. And I drove over to the Target near me. And there's my son in the parking lot. And I pulled up. And I couldn't remember the last time you had such a big smile on your face. He looked so happy. And I rolled down the window. He said, I'm ready, Mom. Let's go. I'm ready to go. And he jumped in the car, and I was just praying, oh, my God, do they even have a bed? And we called, and they're like, yeah, that bed is open. The person who was supposed to come didn't come, so, yeah, come on over.
And then they asked me, when I finished detox, do you want to stay for the residential program? And I don't know what it was. The words that were supposed to come out of my mouth were, no, I'm okay. And the words that came out of my mouth were, sure, why not? And I think it's because for the first time I saw the universe, spirit of Christmas, whatever you want to call it, conspire in my favor to give me another shot. And I got my violin back and started practicing again. And I got did a bunch of workouts with my hands so that I could use those tendons. And I started playing guitar and violin again. And now violin work covers most of my expenses in my life, you know, and I'm not homeless anymore. You know, and it's hard. You know, I still struggle like everyone else does. But I committed to the second chance that I got. And it's 3 years now. It'll be 3 years the day after Christmas that I will have been sober.
That's Elliot Orion playing the violin just last week in North Hollywood. All of these stories produced by KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo, with original score and sound design by our audio engineer, John Meek. Thank you if you reached out to share your holiday memories. And happy holidays to you. Straight ahead on Greater LA, the year in review in Orange County, Gustavo Arellano looks back and marvels at all the news out of OC. That's yours after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis, and it is our last 2022 trip down to Orange County. Ronald Reagan called it the place where good Republicans go to die. The once solidly red county has gone purple. Its board of supervisors is blue for the first time since the 1970s. The board just ended its first green power agency after complaints it wasn't being transparent with consumers. We're going to talk about all that and more with Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times and, of course, our regular weekly guest here at GLA. And he's here with his thoughts on the year in news from OC. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
We've been talking about the purplification, for lack of a better word, of Orange County for years now. And it culminated, at least countywide, with the Board of Supervisors election just this past November. It's now majority Democratic. What does that mean symbolically, and what does it mean politically?
Well, symbolically, it's huge. The Board of Supervisors had not been Democratic, a majority, since the 1970s. And so to have what's the ostensible rulers of Orange County to be three of them Democrats, of course, you're going to see the Democratic Party use that in campaigning, use that to try to motivate candidates, lower candidates, say, like, look, we are now the party in power. Politically, this new board doesn't start until January. So it's going to be interesting, though, because you have Vince Sarmiento's the new supervisor. Katrina Foley, she is on the Board of Supervisors right now, but now she represents a district down in South Orange County, which historically has been very conservative. And then you have literally the man in the middle, the chair, Doug Chafee, who's a moderate Democrat who has swung with the Republicans in the past. That's why the Democratic Party of Orange County ran a more progressive opponent against him, a progressive Democrat, and he soundly beat her. So it's not going to be 100% progressive, and really both sides are going to be jockeying for favor from Chafee. So he's now the most powerful politician in many ways in Orange County.
Does the county still lean Republican, Gustavo? Do you think in other ways, though?
Look, the Democrats have, 80,000 voter advantage in terms of voter registration. Of course, there's a lot of independents, but the soul of Orange County will always be Republican. Even the Democrats, we all have a bit of Republican in us, the nasty Republican. So it's always going to be a battle for the soul. When is our Republican side going to come out? You still have Republicans dominating, definitely the school boards across Orange County, a lot of the city councils, especially in Central Orange County and South. I mean, look at Huntington Beach, which had a majority Democratic council for about a year. Now it's majority Republican. We're talking about rock-rib Republicans are already trying to take back everything that the Democrats did. So especially as 2023 is an off year for elections, with the 2024 election, especially if you're not going to have a Donald Trump as a Republican candidate, the Republicans are just biding their time and trying to mount another comeback. But at the same time, the Democrats are like, let's actually operate as a winning party instead of the losing party that we operated on for a generation.
We talked about the Board of Supervisors. There's another saying, in addition to the Ronald Reagan saying that I mentioned, with great power comes great responsibility, especially when it comes to power, as in electricity down in OC. One of the actions that the supervisors took recently was to leave the OC Power Authority, which is an agency created a couple of years ago to offer renewable energy. So what happened there?
Yeah, so it seems like such a obvious thing, and also kind of radical in Orange County. Here is a power authority where people can buy their energy instead of going through SoCal Edison or some of the local municipalities that have their own electrical production. Let's go green. Let's go 100% green. But this has been just swamped in controversy almost from the start. You had multiple audits, you had grand jury investigation, and so they do have client cities. The Orange County Power Authority has client cities of Fullerton, Buena Park, Irvine, and Huntington Beach, but they didn't tell people that, oh yeah, your rates are going to go up. Oh yeah, like there's just been a lot of transparency issues. So at this last board meeting, remember, it's still majority Republican, they voted to cancel it. And Lisa Bartlett, who is, she's termed out, longtime Republican down in South Orange County, going to be replaced by Katrina Foley. She was the one that was really grilling the CEO of the Power Authority, and at one point said, like, hey, I want answers. The guy gave her answers, and she flat out told them, these are not answers. And so she voted against it. And so what this means, though, is for the parts of Orange County that the Board of Supervisors represents, so we're talking about the unincorporated areas of Orange County, they're not going to be part of this.
They're not going to be. And some of the bigger cities, right? Some of the areas that were affected are the places where a lot of people live.
Yeah, well, those are all individual contracts, so it remains to be seen. But this is a huge blow to the Power Authority. Again, they're trying to sell green energy. They're trying to make money off of it. They proclaim themselves to be a way forward that, hey, if Orange County, deep red Orange County, historically deep red Orange County, can get into the green revolution, so should everyone else. And now the Board of Supervisors, literally the County of Orange, is saying, nope, we don't buy it. We literally don't buy you, and we don't buy into that.
Let's talk about street food vendors, taco stands, and the like. They don't use green power, more like tanks of propane and charcoal.
Chorizo power.
They have proliferated all over Orange County in recent years, but now cities like Anaheim are cracking down on them. What's the scene like there now?
Well, so in Anaheim, this never used to exist. So the city has been cracking down nonstop for the past couple of years. When I talk about street vendors, we're talking about people setting up a tent, setting up Kleg lights, and setting up tables. And so yesterday, the city of Santa Ana, bragged, basically. We shut down over 100 street vendors over the past 6 weeks because they're selling food that is not edible to the public, which to me is like, come on. These people have been there forever. It's just that they're claiming that they're not from Orange County. They're from L.A. So another battle between Orange County and L.A.
Another battle. And, you know, obviously an issue that L.A. has reckoned with, too. As of 2017, street food vending is not a criminal offense in L.A. What direction do you think OC will go? I mean, because this has been a battle between the street food vendors and also the restaurants that feel a bit like, you know, encroached on their turf, right?
Yeah, look, my wife runs a restaurant. People will tell me, well, how would you feel if someone set up a stall in front of her? And my response is, when it comes to food vending, I am the most libertarian possible. It's like, let the market decide.
Well, the free market has decided on the best Christmas Spanish language songs that you and a colleague there, the list of the 24 best Spanish language songs for the LA Times. And do you have a favorite, Gustavo?
Yeah, me and Susie Exposito, we span all sorts of genres. My personal favorite Christmas song from Mexico is called La Rama. It comes from the state of Veracruz. Gorgeous Son Jarocho that Los Lobos covered a couple years ago. But I would be remiss if not mentioning the all-time greatest Spanish language Christmas song of all time,
yeah,
alternately called El Burrito de Belén or El Burrito Sabanero.
All right, hit it, Phil. Now, this is a different kind of burrito, right? We're not talking about the burrito from a taco stand.
No, of course not. It's a burro. We're talking about a little donkey. So the song, it's sweet. It's from Venezuela originally. This is played all over Latin America, and it's about a group of kids going to Bethlehem on, you know, on a little burrito, on a little burro. And it's the most iconic line is tuki, 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 ta. That needs no translation. It's joy. It's Christmas joy.
It's Christmas joy. Let's hear it. Gustavo Arellano, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year. Thank you, my friend.
Gracias, as always.
That's going to do it for us this evening. We are out for the holiday break with some great shows and encores that you may have missed. A couple of L.A. dining institutions celebrating their anniversaries this year, and the style and performances that they bring to the table. And we'll share some of the best of our Born and Raised series about changing neighborhoods throughout greater L.A. It's all coming up next week on GLA. What are your thoughts? Do you have a story idea for us? Let us know at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. And, of course, subscribe to the podcast, too, right there. Juliana Mayo, Nihar Patel, Sonia Geis, Arnie Seipel, Danielle Chiriguayo, John Meek, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Camito, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped put this episode together this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy Hanukkah. Happy New Year to you and yours from all of us at Greater LA and KCRW.